Good afternoon. We want to get started because we have a hard stop at 6:30. Well, welcome everyone and thank you for coming. I'm David Kasich from In Vivo Magazine, and on behalf of Paul Yock and the Biodesign team, we really are fortunate tonight to have really an extraordinary family. For those of you who have been to Innovators Workbench, we're going to have a slight variance or deviation from our normal path. The Fischels have been, I think, without question, the most creative family. Probably each one of them individually would have some claim to extraordinary levels of creativity in the device space. Put together, it's just been an extraordinary run. And so we're actually going to go through a slide presentation outlining the accomplishments of the Fischels. I'm going to turn the program over to David Fischel, who's then going to begin the program, introduce the rest of his panelists. We're going to have a Q&A after that, so have your questions ready. And as I said, we have a hard stop at 6:30. So David, let me kick the program off by inviting you up here.
Thank you. I'm going to step down here for a second. I'm going to begin by just saying what we're going to talk about, which is we're going to introduce a little bit ourselves and our history, and then talk about three of the somewhere between 10 and 15 companies and the 40 or 50 inventions that we've worked on in the medical device field since my dad got started at it in 1969, and then we'll have a little discussion. Let's begin in 1969 when my dad invented a rechargeable pacemaker and got a friend of his named Alfred Mann, who ran a solar cell company, to start a company called Pacesetter Systems. Pacesetter, as many of you know, is the pacemaker part of St. Jude Medical's, the second largest pacemaker company in the world today. A few years later, with the interest of NIH, he invented, was one of the inventors of the ICD, was involved in inventing a drug pump that led to the founding of MiniMed Technologies, now part of Medtronic. And then we started going, and by the way, the key is, this is the key to the invention. All the companies are in white. So the first was Robert, then Tim and Robert started about the mid-80s. I was working for Bell Labs at the time. And then I jumped in around 1990 and involved in atherectomy catheters, a company called Med Innovations, a sheath, radioactive stents that led to a company called Isostent that you'll hear about today. Then we got into neurology. Started a company called NeuroPace, which is in Mountain View, that does brain pacemakers based on an idea the two of us worked on for cranially implanted pacemakers for epilepsy. Then we got back into stents, worked with Cordis, designed what's called the BX Velocity stent, which when they put drug on is called Cypher. Came up with three companies in the early 2000s, a company called AffMedica doing implantable drug release systems for preventing scar tissue on adhesions and other surgical applications, a company called Neuraleve, which is in Sunnyvale, now called eNeuro Therapeutics, that has a transcranial magnetic stimulation device for migraines, and Angel Medical that I'm running in Shrewsbury, New Jersey, we'll talk about today, having heart attack detection. The OsteoPro guiding device you're going to hear about today from Tim, a company called Osteo Solutions, and the stent on a wire, which will be part of the stent talk, that is a company called Svelte Medical, a New Jersey company. And then, since everyone's getting into renal denervation, we have a renal denervation company called Ablative Solutions, which we're not going to talk about today. And that was Tim and me. So the baton has somewhat been passed, although Robert is still very involved in all of the other companies. So first of all, this serves as our disclosure of interest in each and every one of these medical companies. As I know, being a university trustee, you have to deal in the conflict of interest stuff. So that's very important. Okay? And so let me introduce my father, Robert Fischel. He is a BSME from Duke University, MS and Doctor of Science from the University of Maryland, He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, 30 years at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, where he basically invented a lot of the technologies associated with making the GPS satellites for the Navy successful so our submarines couldn't be detected so we could win the Cold War. He has 160 issued US patents, huge number of international ones. In 1984, he was voted Inventor of the Year for the United States. He's on the medical faculty at Johns Hopkins and a trustee of the University of Maryland, and I could go on. We don't have enough time. So I'm going to turn it over to Robert, and I will state pointed things for him.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My talk will be about stents, where my sons and I have devoted quite a bit of time in our life. And they are the world's most successful medical device. And the picture you see there is one of our stents, and I'll describe how we improve them. I'll begin by talking about a beginning of the field of opening blockages in coronary arteries, which was a procedure invented by Andreas Grunzig a long time ago. And as you see on the upper right there, that's what a plaque-obstructed artery would look like. There's to use a long catheter with an inflatable balloon, and they would inflate it and with salt water to a pressure of about 300 psi, which is about 30 times what's in my car's tires, and it would open the blood vessel. Well, that sounds like a great idea, and it was the first thing that was done to open blocked arteries. Well, but how did it do? Well, balloon angioplasty had a six-month 50% failure rate. So they tried directional atherectomy to cut out the plaque instead of just pressing it open. Well, that was a little better, 47%. Then they tried, everybody should try lasers for something, and 55% failure rate. Then they tried grinding it with a rotoblader and transluminal extraction catheters, all of them about a 50% failure rate. So then their early stents had high thrombosis rate, and they were also no better than balloons. But finally, in 1994, Palmarchat stent finally showed a device better than balloons with only a 25% restenosis rate, and it was twice as good, and as a result, it's made stents some of the most used medical devices in the world. So what did we do with that? Well, as it said, in the early 80s, Julio Palmas invented modern balloon expandable stents. Our first patent was filed in 1987 on a stent design. In 1989, Tim and I invented a radioisotope stent, and I'll describe to you that method of innovation. We were both sitting at a meeting of TCT, Transcatheter Therapeutics. Then, at that time, it was the second such meeting. They had about 200 people. Today, I bet they have 20,000, and someone showed a picture of something that they called a stent. And he said, and when we open it with the balloon, it opens the artery. But the only problem we have is that through the interstices of the stent when it's open, tissue, scar tissue forms, and we're getting about a 35-40% failure rate. So I did turn to Tim and we talked about it. I said, well, why don't we put on a short-range beta particle emitting isotope, and that would prevent the cells from going through, and we could solve the problem of restenosis. And so we started a company called IsoStent with a sort of local group you might know called Kleiner Perkins. We had an idea, they had money, that looked like a good combination. Anyhow, so we worked on that, and we invented something very important. I'll show you in some pictures, some undulating connectors to make the Palmaz stent flexible. Palmaz was so stiff it could only go into the early part of the artery. We made them flexible so they could go around a right angle bend and go everywheres in the coronary circulation. So by 1998, we had the good fortune that J&J acquired our stent technology, and we began to design for J&J something called the BX Velocity stent. Now, I have to tell you a very quick story that they only wanted to call the Velocity stent, but I wanted it to be BX Velocity because it's balloon expandable, and I thought expandable The word began with an X. Later on, somebody told me it was an E, but by then it was too late. So at any rate, in 2000, Cordis brings to market our stent and with a peripheral stent called Genesis. 2001, they put sirolimus on it, on the structure that we invented, and they called it Cypher. And in 05, we invented stent on a wire, and I'm going to describe that to you as our latest stent, which is being passed around. If you should get to see the stent, you'll see a stent on a balloon which is on a wire, and you'll see that before it's delivered, it's so small, you do need the magnifying glass I sent around so you can see it. And in 2007, we formed this company, Svelte Medical Systems, to commercialize this stent on a wire design. And in 2009, it was commercialized as a bare stent, and now we're using it in our first-in-man drug-eluting studies. So the structure that we invented is shown here. And it was a new concept in separating the parameters of strength to hold the artery open and flexibility so it would go around corners. And David's going to show you now the part which is the strength part, that when it opens, it acted like a scaffold to strongly hold the artery open. But he'll show you what was called, I love the term, undulating longitudinal structures. Now that's something for a patent, I'm glad to say. And that added the flexibility that would bring that stent anywheres. And so that structure, which is shown here, very enlarged, and Dave will show you the undulating part, highly magnified, and the part that acted as a scaffold to hold the artery open. They put a drug called sirolimus or rapamycin, had the same name on it, and that was the Cypher stent sold by the Cordis Corporation. And how did it do in our first pig test? We always, pig coronary arteries are very close to human, and they're excellent thing for a first trial before we do human subjects. So if you look at the control, you'll see it in the upper drawing, a cross-section of a pig artery that had a control stent that had no drug on it. And in the bottom left, you'll see how much scar tissue was formed. But on the right side, you see with sirolimus, dramatically less. And human beings have the good fortune of having even a better reaction to this drug. And would you believe it only exudes about 10 micrograms of sirolimus will keep old arteries open after stenting. So how are our results with this stent? Well, in our pilot study with a very good doctor, at 4 months to 24 months, no restenosis, much better than 50%, you'll notice. Revel study, 120 patients, again, no failures in 2 years. Then we tried to use it in stents that had already restenosed and reclosed. Again, superb success. And then we did a study, and now we let all kinds of cardiologists join the study, which shows there's a little difference in quality between our first selected cardiologists and the ones who had a failure rate of 6-7%. That's still nothing to be ashamed of. So it was a great success. So BX Velocity, a market success. It was launched in Europe in 99, in the US in the summer of 2000. By December 2001, J&J market share increased to 35% with the BX Velocity stent, that's without drug elution, from 5% to 35%. And then their sales with the Cypher stent finally went to about $3 billion a year. So they were very happy with us, and we were very happy with them. So how do they do since that time? Now, if you study this chart, you'll see what in red are stent sales in billions of dollars by the leading companies in the world, J&J, Guidant, Boston Scientific, Medtronic. And sales peaked in 05 about $6 billion. So, and initially, around 96, J&J was doing really well. They had a very high market share. But then they started losing it, and then they asked the Fischels to join Cordis and see what we could do. So by about 1998, they commercialized our first invented stent, which was highly flexible and still very strong to open arteries, and that was the BX Velocity that I showed you a picture of. And then How'd they do after that? Well, they bought another stent company called the Connor Stent Company in about 07, 08, and they said, well, a month after they bought it, it completely failed this clinical trial. They said, well, now, you know, we're going to have to get rid of the Fischels because all they want to do are Fischel stents. And even a person without a great deal of training in geometry can see what happened with Cordis Corporation in the red. They went down to, by the mid-2011, down from $3 billion to zero. And they've given up at this moment doing coronary stents. So, but what did we do? We said, well, we're going to take some of our inventions and make a stent that's so small, we're going to call it Svelte. And for those who are not familiar with that word, it's not a commonly used word, it means, if you look up in the Webster Dictionary, attractively slim, particularly pertaining to women. However, we have it particularly pertaining to a stent. And the beauty of this stent is as follows, that the stent is, there's a wire, which is the guide wire that you need, and a balloon around that wire, and the stent put around that. And what's very important, you see in green, and David will point to it, in front, there's a balloon control band that's very slight taper and very lubricious, which prevents the leading edge of the stent from being felt by the blockage. So this will slip through even a 99% closed stenosis, even without predilatation. And there's another one at the end, so they have, I won't go into it in the short time I have, but many valuable effects like in refolding the balloon. And here is a comparison of the size of the Svelte stent on the balloon with the leading stent sold in the world, the Abbott Zion stent, and it has slightly less than one half the cross section of the smallest stent in the world, so it can go anywhere and be extraordinarily efficient. So how did it do in its first trials? Well, because we don't need to predilate, because it'll slip into anything, a typical stenting with predilatation with a balloon takes 44 minutes, and ours takes only 20. A 55% reduction in procedure time. So a physician can do twice as many cases in a day. It's easier for the physician and patient and reduces lab costs by about $1,000 for every case. And also 58% reduction in radiation dose to patient and doctor, and 23% reduction in injected contrast, which is very much beneficial for the patient and reduces costs for the cath lab. So that is my story about stents, of how we did some inventing and we got it some sold to some people. And I'm glad to say that Abbott and Boston Scientific are still selling stents that are highly flexible from some of the Fischel patents. And maybe someday Cordis will be back in the business. So now it's my pleasure to, and please save your questions till the end on this subject, as with the others by my son David and Tim. So I'd like to introduce one of my two sons, of which I'm both extremely proud. David Fischel is a PhD. He got his BS in engineering physics and MS and PhD in applied physics from Cornell University. He was 11 years at Bell Laboratories till I talked him out of it to join our little family business. He has only 106 issued U.S. patents, which is still probably better than average. And he's a primary designer of the final BX design, BX Velocity, Cypher stents, and amongst many other honors and distinctions, a trustee of Cornell University. It gives me great pleasure and pride to introduce my son, Dr. David Fischel.
This is going to be kind of a multimedia presentation. He's going to stand up, I'm going to stand down. Tim's going to try and stand on the edge, and we could all see if he falls off. Thank you all for coming today. I'm going to talk to you about something that's related to the coronary arteries, which is heart attacks. Everyone knows someone who's had a heart attack or died of a heart attack. It's a big problem. There are about 1.2 million heart attacks every year in the U.S. Somewhere between a quarter and a little more than a third of all the patients who have one die. This is not a good thing. Half die before they reach the hospital. On the other hand, that means half die after they reach the hospital, and that's very expensive. for the healthcare system. The survivors, most are left with some permanent damage to their heart. The real issue is the longer that coronary artery, which has had a plaque rupture and is now closed with a blood clot, the longer it stays closed, the more less oxygen gets to the downstream heart muscle, and the more of it will die. And to the point that for every 30-minute delay in getting it open, there's a 7.5% increase in mortality and an 8.7% increase in low ability of the heart to pump the blood, which can lead to heart failure. In spite of our hospitals and our doctors doing great, once the people get there to get them treated, the problem hasn't solved the mortality because the patients are waiting too long to go to the hospital. And part of the reason is that after 10 years of education, it still takes them 3 hours to get there. And about 35 to 40% of heart attack patients end up in heart failure, which is the single most expensive thing to our healthcare system. If it's your second or third heart attack, the rate doubles. It goes up to almost 80%. So that if you don't want a first heart attack, you absolutely do not want to have the second one. And finally, it takes just as long for patients on their second heart attack to get to the hospital as it does on the first. Come on. So this is a look at what happens in a coronary artery when your plaque ruptures. There is a thin layer over lipids, some fatty stuff, that's the plaque. When it ruptures, the blood sees the fatty stuff and starts to form a blood clot. As that blood clot forms, a piece of your EKG called the ST segment, this little piece here, which is measuring the heart as it prepares for the next beat, and it's moving ions into the heart muscle, and it moves it faster in the area that's affected and thinking you're exercising, creates an electrical imbalance in the heart and a change in the signal that looks like that. And that's what we measure. And it turns out if you measure it from inside the heart, it's incredibly accurate, incredibly fast. Come on. Oops. Yeah, I don't know why this is not working. Go back, previous slide.
Harry, what is it?
I'm okay, fine.
That's a typical male in the United States having a heart attack. I'm okay, I'm fine. It turns out that married men get to the hospital faster because their wife calls 911. One of the patients who qualified for our study because he had had a first heart attack, his wife's telling me after taking 20 Tums, because indigestion is one of the things that it feels like, she finally said, look, I'm calling 911 and either you're going or I'm going. So it's a big deal. There we go. So this is mortality versus time. Where we are today is you get there in 3 hours. It takes an hour to an hour and a half to get treated, so you're at point B. And what we've done over the last 10 years is go from A to B, and as you can see, it hasn't improved mortality. What we want to do is we want to get you up here. To get there, that means you got to get in an hour. So in the hour, an hour and a half it takes to get treated in the hospital, you're not going to die and you're not going to have permanent damage to your heart. So what we've developed is what we call the Guardian system. It's a device that is implanted like a pacemaker. And so it attaches to a standard pacemaker lead. It's put in at about half an hour under a local anesthetic. And so it can be done by any doctor that knows how to put a pacemaker in. But it doesn't pace. What it does is it monitors your heart in patients who've survived a first heart attack to make sure that they get a warning that their artery is closed so they go right away and they don't wait for hours to go to the hospital. And it turns out that when it detects that ST change indicating that you've had a heart attack, not only does it have a vibrator like your cell phone, but the patients get a beeper that will beep and flash. Well, this thing is vibrating. And trust me, they know it's going off, and they immediately can take this device and turn off the alarm, call 911, and get to that hospital as fast as possible, because if they wait, they could die. And the patients respond really well to this. They also tell us it gives them an incredible peace of mind knowing that this thing is, you know, like a guardian angel looking out for them. I do have to tell this story because my daughter requires me. Her name is Jennifer. She was in the car with my dad and mom on our way to a family reunion. We were thinking of a name for the company. And she said, "Dad, how about calling it Angel Medical, because it's like a guardian angel?" We said, "That's a really good idea, Jennifer. And she insists I always mention it. She wanted a royalty. I said, "How about I pay for your college education?" She's now a junior at Cornell. So come on. There we go. Okay. I better step up here. I'm afraid this is not working. Okay. All right. Just go through this one. To the next slide. Okay. This is no longer a science experiment. We started in 2006, actually doing human implants. We're now in more than 500 patients with more than 600 patient years of data. Our most recent data is on the 73 patients that are not in our big study for the FDA, because we're not allowed to look at that data. And there we saw over a two-year follow-up that we, in 18% of these patients in 2 years, we actually detected a real heart attack, with only 3% of them having a false positive detection that wasn't real. And most of those were the patients failed to take their medicine or something that actually caused something that we detected. We've published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. We are commercially selling in Brazil. We're approved to sell in Europe. And over 10,000 St. Jude ICDs and pacemakers have been sold around the world with our algorithm for patients who need pacemakers or ICDs. Next slide. So I'm going to give you one of these example of one of these patients. And this patient is a cardiac nurse in Michigan at 6:30 in the morning. She had her alarm went off. She started to have symptoms. She called 911. By 7 a.m., she was had an EKG in the ambulance. And you know, they didn't really see anything there. She said, "You know, this thing went off. You better turn the lights on and take me quickly to the hospital." So they took her to the hospital. And by 7:20, 50 minutes later, now all of a sudden you're seeing this on the surface. All right? And they saw this. They said, "Oops, this is a heart attack." That's what a heart attack looks like on a surface EKG. They rushed her into the cath lab, where they found almost totally occluded coronary artery. They put a stent in, opened it up. Within an hour and a half, remember I said you want to get under that two and a half hour time frame, she's doing fine with no damage to the heart because the thing got her in there so quickly. And the time, under 2 hours. So in looking at every medical device, a key aspect of it is what is the risk versus benefit for the device. For a pacemaker, the real risk to the patient is that they can develop an infection. And it's about a 1 or 2% chance, and it's treatable with antibiotics. But as we get to a device like this that will have a 7-year battery life, which is what our next device will have for commercial, over that time, remember I said 18% of them had a detected heart attack in 2 years, over 7 years, it's going to be more like 40 to 50%. So almost half the patients, we could save their life versus a treatable infection. But it also measures other aspects of the coronary disease that can help. So almost every patient will get some benefit here. We're now in the middle or toward the end of a major study for the FDA. And in this study, every patient gets the device. And for the first 6 months, the control group, although the device is detecting heart attacks, we turn off the alarms. And then at 6 months, we turn the alarms back on for them. And it's as fair as we can make it, and as we tell the people in the control group, don't feel too bad. It's only 6 months. If you didn't get the device, you'd be in the control group for the rest of your life, because you would never have this advantage. So everyone gets something. And at the end of the study, when we get to, we hope, 600 patients, we'll have somewhere around maybe 40 or 50 heart attacks. And then we can see a difference and how many have a cardiac death, a new Q wave, which is an indication you've actually damaged the heart tissue in a major way, or you got to the hospital more than 2 hours after our detection, which is another indication if it's a real blood clot that's closed your artery that you've had damage to your heart. So the history is, in 1999, this was one that my dad got the idea first. He saw a device in Israel, a Surface system, that kind of could send data out to another place. Someone would look at it and be able to know if you were having a heart attack. He says, you know, that makes no sense. You can't wear it all the time. And having invented ICDs and implantable pacemakers, he said, you've got to put this inside the heart. So we talked to our favorite interventional cardiologist and said, let's take a pig and let's open a balloon angioplasty catheter inside this pig's coronary artery, which, by the way, totally blocks the blood, just like a blood clot, and let's see what we measure from inside the pig's heart. And son of a gun, the signal was huge. It was way better than anything we could measure on the surface. We said, you know, we might have something here. So we said, you know, I bet since you're already opening these angioplasty balloons in all these patients anyway, they wouldn't mind if we measured the electrical signal from inside their heart. Well, you do it. We got them to consent. So we actually tested, would it work on people? And sure enough, the signal was huge inside the heart, way better than anything you could see on the surface. So that pushed us to the next level to actually create an algorithm. And the hard part wasn't detecting the heart attack. It was keeping all the other crazy things the heart does, arrhythmias, preventricular contraction that causes all kind of strange things in the signal from fooling the device. So we did our first animal in 2004. I hate to say the pig died, but we detected the heart attack properly. So that was a very good thing. Our first in man was in 2006. We did a safety study for the FDA starting in 2007. Our big study began in 2009, paper in 2010. And we expect to file the PMA with the FDA next year on the data from our study. And now it is my pleasure to introduce my middle of, we're three brothers, so I'm the oldest and Tim is the middle brother. Tim has AB and MD from Cornell University. He did his residency in internal medicine at Mass General, which is part of Harvard. And then he came to this university you guys may have heard of on the West Coast called Stanford. You know, they kind of got red and white colors, kind of like Cornell, but and have a tree outside of it, which I hear is the fear of the tree, it said, right, Paul? He's now associate professor. He then became associate professor and cath lab director at Vanderbilt. He's currently professor of medicine at Michigan State University and the director of cardiovascular research at the Borges Hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is the eighth largest interventional cardiology center in the United States. He has more than 80 U.S. patents. He's on the Abbott Advisory Board, and it goes on and on. He is a heck of an inventor, and he is CEO of the new renal denervation company, Ablative Solutions, so he's getting his hand into the corporate work as well.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to come.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to run my own slides, see if that'll work. But it's really great to come back to Stanford, and I want to thank Paul Yock and the BioDesign team, you know, for having us out here. It's really always nostalgic for me. I spent some of my happiest time here and some of my most productive and learning time at Stanford. It's a great university, and so I'm very happy to be back, and thank you for the invitation. I'm going to talk a little bit about one of my sort of, we heard about define a problem, define a need from Paul today. And this happened about 6 years ago, where in 1 week, around 2003, I had to place stents in the right coronary at the ostium in three consecutive, and two on a Wednesday, one on a Thursday. I worked meticulously, looking at multiple views, tried to line it up. Go ahead. And after pulling the balloon, I deployed the stent, thought it was absolutely perfect, pulled the balloon back to try to flare it open and see this tight waist on the balloon, which means I missed the ostial plaque. And so I'd put a second stent in. I'm like, after the third time in 1 week, I kind of hit my fist on the counter inside the control room, and I said, we're going to do something like that. There has to be a better way. This is a problem. There is a need. So the rationale here for this concept was there's a need, and the anatomy of positioning with angiographic landmarks is nearly impossible. It's misleading, ambiguous, and therefore we very frequently misplace the stents. We put them too distal. We don't even recognize it. They re-block, or we do recognize it, have to put a second drug-eluting stent in, overlap it. Sometimes you miss it distal, then you miss it proximal, and you don't want to miss it, so you stick the other one into the aorta. That's a proximal miss, and you can never reintubate the right coronary or the left main again. It's an even worse problem. Next slide. So this is actually a big problem. It's about 6% of all stents are placed at the coronary ostium. It'd be more if we could do it accurately. Some doctors don't do it for left main because they're so afraid they can't get the stent right. So it is critical. We wanted to make a device that could do it very quickly and with very small margins of error. There are about almost 300,000 renal and coronary aortoosteal lesions stented every year worldwide next. So this is a typical example of what happens when you miss. You can see this was what happened 3 or 4 months after a stent was placed in this patient's right coronary. We did intravascular ultrasound, Paul Yocks, great invention. And we see right here with ultrasound, the stent looks perfect. There's no problem. And then we look where the blockage is, and there's something missing here, stent. There are no struts. So this was a typical distal miss, not recognized, restenosis, restent, hopefully got it right the second time. Next slide. So this really happens all the time. We miss it. We don't know we miss it. They re-block. We go, what? Look at the high restenosis rate in osteo lesions. So I said, why don't we have something that can visually, mechanically, tactically, in every way, give us a standoff so that the guiding catheter can no longer go into the coronary. We can mark it visually and mechanically and tactically. We can see it, feel it. We can pull the stent back, line it up within literally 1 or 2 tenths of a millimeter and get it right just about every time. So this is an animation of what I invented, you know, back around 1994 with David and my father. And this is a guiding catheter. It goes into the right coronary. We have plaque buildup. You can see the OsteoPro is parked inside the guide, made out of nitinol. We put the wire down. The stent goes right through the cylinder of the OsteoPro. We then pull the guiding catheter back. The nitinol legs are then advanced and will pop out. It's kind of cool when they pop. And then you push the guide forward, and now the guide sits just outside the ostium. The gold feet mark where it is. You pull it, line it up with the tip of the guide as the marker, deploy it, take the OsteoPro out, flare it, and you can get it right about 99% of the time instead of about 50% of the time. Go on, next. So, next. This is a left main, unprotected left main. Now, this for some people is like, oh, this is too dangerous. You know, you can't put stents in, partly because they're afraid they can't get the stent correctly placed at the ostium. You'll see why. Most people would think that the ostium is about where the red line is. I call that the false ostium. The ostium of this left main is actually back here. As you'll see, after we place the stent, it's actually the edge of the stent was placed here after the OsteoPro was used. So this is time and time and time again, the doctors tell us, and over 5,000 cases have been used, I never would have guessed that's where the ostium was. And this is why we miss a lot. Next, there's the IVUS showing it's right on. We've done it in renals. Done many renals. Again, same problem. Some doctors say, well, you know, I got the solution. Here's the OsteoPro with the legs out, marking the plane of the aorta. You pull the stent back, deploy it, and then you can see it's just absolutely flush. You can re-engage. It doesn't stick out. It sticks flush, and you have low restenosis rates. Next. This is a real sort of a live case angiographic study of a right coronary ostium, and you can see the OsteoPro coming out, the legs out against the aorta. I can't see it that well. And the stent's pulled back, positioned, deployed, flared, and then you get this like every time. So it's just dead flush, re-engage, and rather than missing, you can get it right. So we looked at this in the first 30 cases we ever did. This was from N equals 1, the first case we ever did to the next 30, and we looked at it angiographically and with IVUS, and we got it dead perfect in 30 consecutive cases. We looked at totally consecutive control cases of osteo lesions with very experienced operators, and they missed 18 out of 30 times. So the miss rate is way higher than people think, and arrogant interventional cardiologists say, I don't really need it. You know, I can see it. I can't see it. Next. And we just published these data showing, is it of any consequence to miss? Well, not only if you stick it out proximally, you can't ever re-engage the coronary, and then people come with a heart attack, and you sit here for 2 hours trying to get into the coronary. That's a big problem. But if you miss distally or proximally, we also have recently showed you have triple the restenosis rate, triple the TLR if you miss versus hitting it right flush. Next. So this is one of my colleagues up in Grand Rapids who's adopted this early adopter. And he said, you know, I've done more than 80 cases with the OsteoPro. I use it in 100% of the cases. It improves the outcome for patients. I believe it should be the standard of care for stenting of the ostium. This device was, and the company, we just sold it to Merit Medical, who is launching it worldwide. Next slide. Go ahead. So the conclusions, this device met a need. It's a simple tool, compatible with every guiding catheter made, every stent made for renals and coronaries. It's a very simple device to use, improves clinical outcomes. Had has been used now in over 5,000 clinical cases and is now being marketed and launched worldwide by Merit Medical. So this is, you know, relatively small compared to some of the other things that David and Robert talked about, but I'm very proud of making this easier, and now I don't get frustrated in the cath lab anymore putting in ostial stents. Thank you for your attention. We're going to take a panel now. No? Oh, no.
Robert has, sorry.
Robert has four more slides.
Thank you, Tim. So I just have a very few slides to show what our experience of the last 130 years that I've been working on medical devices, why are they a success? Now, I know someone told me a million times not to exaggerate. Why are medical devices successful? First of all, they have to be good for the patient or we will never work on it. They are applicable to a large and hopefully growing patient population. That's where to make a good business of it. The procedure will make more money for the prescribing physician. That is a truism. If they lose money by doing it, they will not do it. The medical procedure is well known or comparably simple. If it is brand new and very complex, it's not well received. More cost-effective for the hospital, a big deal, an important one today, and will decrease cost and save money for the healthcare system. So these are six important rules. If you're going in the medical device business, you better try to get 6 out of 6. Maybe 5 out of 6 will be a success. 6 out of 6 is better. Well, what lessons have I learned and my sons and I learned over all these years? First of all, give yourself the opportunity to get lucky. Keep working on a lot of things, because many times, problems create excellent opportunities for innovation. Look for something that's not working and say, oh, that didn't work, is what the non-inventor says. The inventor looks at a problem and says, there's an opportunity in workflows. If there's a problem, there's an opportunity. Another thing I found is, when the world gives you lemons, make lemonade. Now, the English translation of that is, when our radioisotope stent didn't work right, but it had a great structure, well, let's put a drug-eluting surface on it and change it and make it from a lemon to very delicious lemonade. And something else I've found out, the harder I work, the luckier I get. That's worked pretty well for the last 40 years. And another thing, do not follow where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and blaze a trail for others to follow. That's what a true inventor in this field would do. And finally, I would like to tell you of this verse by a famous poet from North Carolina who wrote it for an uncle of mine who is a great surgeon, that it's great to really like what you do. In his words, I couldn't express it better. Only when love and need are one and work is play for mortal stakes is the job ever really well done for heaven and the future's sake. And with that, we will conclude our talk of the three of us and now have it open to questions, first from David and then from other people who would like to ask questions from any one of the three of us. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, great. We do now have a couple of minutes for questions, so if you've got some, please make your way to the microphones. Let me ask the first one, and I think it should be obvious to folks who've watched these fascinating presentations that to a certain degree, what you guys have done in Microcosm is what the Biodesign Program is trying to do overall, which is to combine multiple disciplines, particularly engineering and medicine. I wonder if you all could talk a little bit more about how exactly you collaborate, how independently you work, and whether there are any obvious or kind of persistent friction points when physicians and engineers come together, maybe outside of a family setting or inside a family setting.
Well, I would give one example. I would sometimes have to say, oh, I have a great idea, Tim. about this. He says, Dad, you just don't understand cardiology.
No, I think his expression was, that's neat, plausible, and wrong.
That's another thing.
Then there are times the doctor says, you know, can't we do this? And then it says, Tim, that's not an engineering problem, that's a physics problem.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of that is, you know, with our Angelman device. I just thought we were trying to develop some subcutaneous detection system. And I said, well, you know, can't we get an electric signal? We'll just put one electrode here, and we'll put one electrode here. We'll just measure the electric.
And use David, radio to connect them.
And David says, you have to connect them with a wire. That's a physics problem. So this is where the doctor doesn't know. And then, of course, there are times when the physicists don't understand the physiology, and they're coming up with stuff that's,
Do you always the combination is optimum.
Yeah, you have to have both the MD clinician who really understands sort of what's going on, and you have to have the engineer physicist who really understands the technology to make biomedical engineering work.
Do you always, or have you always, bounced ideas off each other? Or do you sometimes just say, I don't care what you guys say, I'm going to go ahead
and do this? How many times do we talk each day, guys?
No, we have all, from the first time when David called me from Bell Laboratories and said, Dad, you're having more fun than I, can I play around medical devices with you? So then a little bit later, Tim joined in the fun. He was at the Mass General and said, Dad, I think there's a great future in opening coronary arteries, when he was training at the Mass General. So we've worked together for a long time.
Yeah, especially in the first 10 or 15 years when, you know, we were mostly on the East Coast, and we would, at Thanksgiving, would be like a classical think tank. You know, Paul showed me his room, what's the room called, where you have your think room? The brainstorming room. So, you know, Thanksgiving, the breakfast room at Willow Oaks at my father's house, that was the brainstorming room. And all the kids and wives would have to clear out because it was way too boring for them.
They finally threw us out and made us go down to the downstairs room once. And my mother insisted that we're not allowed to talk about business during dinner.
But we could do it otherwise.
But we could do it otherwise.
You know, Robert, you mentioned, or you used the phrase, making lemons of lemonade. When we were talking the other night, you used the same phrase, but you used it actually in a slightly different context. And I think for a lot of the folks here in the audience who face obstacles or face impediments or challenges early on, the big issue is, how do you overcome that? And David, I think it was you on the phone who mentioned that each of you, if I might use the phrase that you used, got screwed at one point in your life and had to overcome an early obstacle. I wonder if each of you would talk about that early sense of, this isn't working, these guys are standing in my way, and I've got to get around them.
Well, I'll be very quick. I was at the Johns Hopkins University, where they used to give 25% royalty share to an inventor at Johns Hopkins. And then we got a new director who sent me an email saying, Bob Fischel, you're making more money than I am, so I'm cutting it down to 10%. And I later told him, when the memo came out, I've made my last invention for the Johns Hopkins University.
So what did you do?
I told him later that was the best thing he had ever done for me.
Did you move on to another university, or did you, what exactly did you do after that?
After that, I resigned from the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab.
Yeah, that's where we did the atherectomy invention and started the Med Innovations Company, which was sort of the first startup for a medical device that we did ourselves. But it was primarily my dad, with help from the American Cyanamid, and that was the first thing that got us going.
So Tim, David, do you want to talk about some early obstacles?
Shortly after that, come around 1989, 1990, we finally got the company that had been making the device to actually buy the company and signed a contract to support them in developing the device, regulatory work, research and development. And that's sort of what got me out of Bell Labs. But the real reason I wanted to leave Bell Labs and AT&T is they'd been downsizing for 5 years. Mm-hmm. This company called MCI, may have heard of them, was like eating their lunch by cheating on their books, but that's besides the point. And I'd been on the promotable list for 3 years, and when the project that I had started and put my lifeblood into, that had grown to 80 people and a department, and they didn't give me the job because they were no promotions, that was the time I called them up and said, you know, you're having a lot more fun than I am. What do you say I come work with you on this atherectomy thing? And that's where we got started. Within a couple of years, the three of us invented our next invention, and it just It just happened after that.
Cascade after that. Tim, do you have a...
Yeah, I was after I left Stanford, I went to Vanderbilt University, which is not nearly so, I think, biodesign entrepreneur friendly. And people who were innovators and entrepreneurs were unusual there. And I think they were viewed as some sort of evil, foreign, alien creature and not really well accepted. And after being there for 4 years, the environment just wasn't supporting what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be involved in things like radioactive stent, and I wasn't allowed to go anywhere near it. I, you know, viewed as contaminated. Even though I could let someone else be a principal investigator, I couldn't go near it. And, you know, I wanted to be involved in the things that I was passionate about, and I moved on from Vanderbilt, and that was also one of the best things that happened to me.
And that's when you went to Michigan.
That's when I went to Michigan State, to Borges, and that's been a great place. It's encouraged and allowed me to be an innovator and an entrepreneur and supported that and been proud of it.
Again, I want to encourage you, if you got a question, because we don't have a lot of time, come to the microphone now. But let me also mention one other thing, which is, I think we've been doing this for 10 years now, Paul. This has got to be the only session we've had in which venture capitalists and capital raising has not been raised. So you guys have been behind some phenomenal companies. You started a bunch of companies, you got a bunch of patents. How does the fundraising work for you guys?
Well,
does it get easier when you've got a track record?
Well, like the first fundraising was because Tim played basketball with a life science guy from Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. And that's how we got,
I was very good friends with Joe Lakup, who probably is not here tonight, but Joe was, and it's still a good friend of mine, and we used to play basketball every weekend at the Cadillac Club. And he came to Vanderbilt to visit me when I was at the Cadillac Club, and he goes, "What are you guys doing?" And I said, "Well, we're making this stent with radioactive." He goes, "That's great." He goes, "Why don't you come out and make a presentation?" And before you know it, the three of us went out, made a presentation, and that was our first KP company, and it had to link to that. But I think in answer to
like
question,
for today, how?
Today is different. It's a different world today. It's very challenging. We have some, in our, you know, obviously we're a little bit proud of some of the things we're doing, the Neuralive device, the Svelte device, and I can tell you that I think these are great devices, but the funding for this, even great technologies that have great market potential, is challenging today. If you're in the right space at the right time, you know, we're doing something in renal denervation, which is very, very hot, and, you know, this has got, I mean, it's, I'm turning money away. So it depends where you are, it depends on how good the idea is, and this market is very different and changing.
Yeah, but having the track record does help tremendously. So I would say if it's hard for us to do it,
right?
For somebody without a track record at this point in the medical field, it must be nearly impossible.
How has AngelBed been funded?
It's been funded by primarily strategics, St. Jude Medical, who licensed our patents. And initially Johnson & Johnson.
Well, they're defibrillator. They licensed our heart attack detection patents.
We have two VCs, a bunch of angels. We put some of our own money into it. These days, I would say that we're almost doing better from the strategics, the bigger companies, than you are with some of the VCs. They see a Google or a Facebook, and they see this, you know, 1,000 times return, but there just aren't a lot of those. And they don't have the staying power anymore, I think, many of them, partly because of the issues with the FDA being so difficult in the last 5 to 10 years.
I want to come back to that. I see Mike Billig at the microphone. Mike, do you want to pose a
Bob,
question?
Bob, you've had a lot of accomplishments in your young life. What's the most difficult and most accomplishment that you've really sensed out of all that? What's been the hardest task that you've had?
Well, one of the hardest things was to give up on a radioisotope stent idea, and all we did is invent a much better stent structure and have Johnson & Johnson Cordis take over and give us and sell $3 billion a year of it. So that was some of the hard, but today the hardest thing is what was being raised here. Venture capital today, because of the US FDA, is a serious problem for the United States. It happens to be a problem that I am also personally working on. And so unless you're a very skilled person like Frank Fisher with NeuroPace Company, who has a charmed system of getting money for our great NeuroPace company to treat epilepsy, it's very difficult today with the VCs because of the US FDA.
So let me ask, we're right up against time, let me ask one final question, which is, Robert, I got the sense from your stent example, a touch of frustration working with Cordis. And yet, as David points out, St. Jude is a partner. How do you guys approach dealing with corporates and strategics early on versus late, particularly today with venture capital stress? A lot of corporates are becoming earlier, are coming earlier and earlier into companies.
Yes.
Talk about what lessons you guys have learned working with corporates.
Well, what I learned in working with Cordis Corporation is they got a new man coming in who is a Harvard MDA to head up the research and engineering of a stent. And I, with all due respect for Tim, the engineering of a stent is not a cardiology issue, it's a physics issue, and he's the one who got them to the point where they're not working so well today. So, but now, for example...
Do you agree?
Now, for example,
there's
all new management at Cordis. We happen to be hoping to be visiting with them soon, and that is the place, instead of VCs, we hope to be realigned.
But any lessons in particular, I mean, again, coming back to the notion that you've been through the experience once, what advice would you have to companies that are, to executives who are contemplating whether to talk to that corporate or to keep banging the VC doors?
Well, it's really clear to me, because I both work for big companies, Bell Labs and AT&T, and done the startup thing, that the culture is very different. And it's really clear to me, having tried to start things within a big company, that one, the people who do it don't get a lot of reward for it.
Right.
So they tend to go outward and work outside. In the same time, it's very hard within big companies to start new things. So they need new ideas coming in continually. So there is an opportunity here, but it always can create culture clashes. If you're lucky, you create sort of a sugar daddy or someone within the big company that is sort of your sponsor who believes in you, that will keep it going. Initially, it was an executive named Pat O'Neill, who came in to work for Bob Croce,
sure,
who believed that we could be the right team,
right,
to design the new stent. And within the St. Jude, who we work very closely with Dr. Eric Fain, who runs their cardiac rhythm management. He started on our AngelMed board of directors when he was just a junior VP there. Now he's running the whole cardiac rhythm management. And that has helped facilitate the connections where we help them as well. So it's been critical for us to help them to get our algorithm to work in their devices, because it's our technology, and often they'll want to try and do it themselves, and sometimes that can be an issue.
Tim, I'm going to give you the last word, because you qualify not only as an inventor and as a developer of technology, but also qualify as a KOL. A lot of companies want to learn from you about the interventional cardiology space. What's been your experience working with large corporates?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, there have been, I think a lot of it has to do with the leadership of the company. And I will say, one of the frustrations with Cordis, for example, this concept of changing the president of a interventional cardiology company every 18 months, from someone who's never even heard of interventional cardiology before they were president, then changing that, there has to be, it's always about relationships. I mean, this business, and all businesses, when it comes down to it, it is relationships. Track records are important, interpersonal relationships are important, trust is important, and innovation is important. But if you can establish that with a very good company, you're fortunate to have the personal relationship, the trust, and then you can be a collaborative partner with that big corporation. And that is a great way to go. And in the end, most of us want to create those kind of partnerships with industry.
Well, great. Well, unfortunately, we really are right up against time. There is a reception, but for AV reasons, we've got to close down. We owe the Fischels a lot. Anybody's got a Cypher stent or a BX Velocity stent owes you a double tone of gratitude. And we want to thank you very much for coming and sharing your story. So thanks very much, and thank you all for coming.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.